Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. We're here with Chris Irvin, author of Federales and editor at Shotgun Honey. We're once again being brought to you by High Octane Damnation. This is Renee, and I'm drinking coffee because I have a sinus infection, and after we're done with the show, I have to go pick my mom up from the train station. But it is Descendants bonus cup brew, which is limited edition fancy coffee. So, Chris, how are you doing and what are you drinking?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I'm having Ithaca Brewing Green Trail IPA. Pretty good so far. I think it's part of the whole new wave of kind of drinkable IPAs that are sprouting up all over the place.
Yeah, well, see, because I love IPA, and I'll drink, like, a thick, nasty IPA, but you have to, like, be in the headspace for that.
So I'm and I like, you know, I like having a couple beers, you know, and if you have, you know, a 12 to 14% IPA, that can be kind of rough, especially when, you know, a lot of those come in a bomber, you know, 22-ounce size. That
I drank one of those on the show once. Yeah, it wasn't an IPA, actually. It was what was it? Oh, it was the Woot Stout from Stone and Will Wheaton, but it was a 14% in a big old bottle, and that was a good idea.
Yeah.
Jessica, what are you doing?
I'm liking.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm just I'm liking the kind of trend in these more drinkable ones. It's kind of refreshing to see some different stuff out there.
Yeah. I'm drinking a PBR.
Is that a drinkable PBR?
It's highly drinkable, yeah. You can just drink and drink and drinkable them.
Drink. You know, it's funny, though, Chris, you reminded me, I have a cousin-in-law who's a brewer in England, and she had, like, some really passionate opinions about American IPA. Like, she's like, Americans, they're all, like, in this pissing contest about who can put the most hops in it and how bitter they can make it. And I was like, yeah, I kind of like the really hoppy ones, but maybe you have a point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the whole West Coast versus East Coast and everything in between, so it's interesting.
So, Let's get rolling.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So,
well, are you going or am I?
You go.
Okay, I'll go. Sorry. Anyway, so we read your novella Federales for the show. Such high praise for this. Like I didn't read any bad reviews.
That was the thing I was thinking while I was doing research too. That's weird. Are you paying people to review your book, Chris?
It's been kind of a shock to see just how well it's been received. It's been really nice.
The worst I saw, I think, was like a mild review, like maybe a little lukewarm. Still not bad, though. I didn't read anything bad, but I know the book. Which is about a Mexican federal police agent who kind of retires, and then because he can't deal with that anymore, and then he takes a job doing sort of, I'm going to say bodyguard, is that the right word? Bodyguard work for a politician. And I know the politician in your book is kind of based on a real life small town mayor, right?
Right.
Is it okay to talk about that, or do you think that like kills the book?
No, I don't think so. And I
okay.
have that up front a little bit too, and that's kind of, I think some of the reviews hit on it a little bit as well, that it's noir, so you kind of know going in that it's not going to turn out well.
So it's not a happy story.
Right, exactly. So I haven't really hidden that, you know, and kind of when I've done some of the other posts or interviews about it, I'm kind of pretty upfront about that it's not, you know, it's kind of bleak. So yeah, I think it's fine to go down that road.
Okay, good. I was scared to ask. Anyway, so what is that real life story? What inspired the story for the book, or was it something else, and then that kind of like led into it, or what started?
I did read. I'm gonna qualify your question if you don't mind, Jessica, because I did read that you said that the book kind of started not as something else, but you were already working on it by the time you heard about, I hope I don't butcher this woman's name, Gorostita? Anyway, and then that started to inform the book and inspire the story. So I'm really interested on some background on that. And I know, like, Jessica and I talked about it too. So if you could give us some, like, a little bit more insight into how that process went.
Sure. A little bit of it is kind of foggy for me when I went back and looked at all my notes. I know I found out, I read an article about when she was kidnapped and murdered, and when they found her body. Around that time, I'd gotten the idea of Marcos, the protagonist, the federal agent, and it's not totally clear in my head how they play off one another, but I know he was the main, I mean, they're both kind of main characters, but he, I had written, and I'll avoid, you'll kind of know what I'm talking about, but I'll avoid spoilers, but I had written a scene involving Marcos where there's a kind of twist toward the middle to the end of the book, where he's alone, and I actually started writing the book at that part, and realized I was really interested in that moment on and kind of where he would go in that state. But I was looking at doing a lot of flashbacks if I began at that moment. And I didn't want to interrupt a lot of the book by doing all these flashbacks to moments in time where I was kind of having to do these kind of weird memory cues off of things he might run into or things he might experience. So I kind of realized I need to, if I want to start here, I need to back up and really get to know him and get to know the other characters and kind of lead them through the story or the meat of the story to get to that point, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. One thing I wondered, I guess, is did you do a lot, I'm not going to say your name again because I feel terrible. Like, I usually can pronounce Spanish last names relatively easily because I grew up in California, but that one is killing me, okay? did you do a lot of research on her and use that to inform the Eva character, or did you just sort of, was it more of a general thing, like the sort of reputation that she had and the things that happened, and you just kind of went on to create a wholly different character?
Yeah, Maria, there's not actually a lot available that I could find. I looked, all the articles I looked at from the time she died afterward were all about that, about her running for office and then losing her protected detail. But really outside of that, there wasn't much on her life. There was snippets about her, the assassination attempts on her life, a little bit about her first husband, her second husband who was kidnapped at the same time she was. I don't believe he was ever found, or if they did, there was no news about it. So it seemed like something that was really swept under the rug, once she died, and it appears that it had been so even when she was alive. I couldn't find any, I don't think in American news media was ever interested in it. But there was no Mexican news media outlets that I could find that covered her, while she was alive and kind of during her, movement or crusade. But I guess I didn't have access to kind of local newspapers or anything of that sort, which may have covered her, but nothing really in the mainstream or in kind of major newspapers, which surprised me a little bit. And I kind of bounced some ideas off of other people, and I guess our kind of theories, or maybe it was just swept under the rug because it was such a heated issue and a hot topic, and even when she died, there really wasn't much of an investigation that I could find into who killed her and who kidnapped her. So there's just a, and that's kind of part of what drove me to write a similar story, or a story that kind of spun off of her life, is that there was such a strong mystery involved in her life, and just the fact that, you know, no matter how hard I looked, I couldn't find out much other than how she ended up.
I'm almost positive that I read literally one article about her after she died. And it was one of those things, it's like, why isn't anybody reporting on this? So, yeah, I think it's really cool. And that is sort of, it does give you a little bit more license, I guess. Like, if you were going to write a historical novel, which seems weird because it's contemporary, but you know what I mean.
Right.
If you're using her as a character, you would have to be a lot more careful, I guess.
Right. Well, no, it definitely was something that was on my mind because I didn't want to come off as kind of taking advantage of a tragedy or exploiting it in any way.
Right.
And I think if it had been maybe more of a mystery or action crime thriller, it could have been viewed in that context because it would have been, I mean, I feel like I tried to base it in reality and have a pretty straight take on the subject matter and the story. And if I'd maybe played with some elements where it took it out of believability,
right,
that might have hurt it in that respect.
Well, I think too, like this book is described like over and over again in reviews as being a slow burn, and being rather emotional for as minimal as the writing is. And I think, because I was going to ask, well, was that a conscious choice or was that something you did later? But it sounds like that was, that you were trying very hard to make sure that it wasn't like exploitive or like, you know, some of the crime fiction that's popular now is just like really extreme violence. And that's okay if that's what you like. But in this case, that would have been not, I guess, I hesitate to say it wouldn't have been respectful because, of course, these are fictional characters.
Right.
But do you feel like maybe there was a part of you that was like, I do have to be respectful because I am going to be open about the fact that this character was based on a real person?
Yeah, and I think I in general try to avoid a lot of violence. And I know I'm friends with some of the guys that write very violent work, and I like some of it. I think some of it works very well. I think we are going through a trend, especially in short fiction, where the catalyst for a lot of stories, and we see this at Shock and Honey a lot. I think this actually drives me away from writing a lot of violent stories, or it may be violent on screen, I guess, or on the page, because we see so much of it that doesn't work very well. And and especially when we're looking at 700 words, where if you're in violence is a very easy and I've used it as a catalyst to, you know, drive that 700 words. But if it's, you know, if it's lacking story and it's just this, you know, about once a week we get one that's just basically straight abuse for 700 words of a man beating up a woman or vice versa. To a pretty extreme length sometimes, and it just doesn't work because it doesn't have a story. You know, we're just seeing this kind of violent action for 700 words. So I think that I think you're right in one sense that I didn't want to go there consciously, but in another, I think my style has really drifted away from that.
I think when we're talking about the book in general, we had a listener question from Ellie Ann Soderstrom that I think kind of hits on this. She said, is it intimidating writing about another culture? To which I would kind of want to follow that up with, what made you specifically want to write about the Mexican cartels as opposed to anything else?
Yeah,
well, Can I qualify Jessica's question again? Because we had similar questions,
sure.
Right? So I want to, right? Well, cause the thing is that we've been doing this show together for so long, we can't come up with our own shit anymore.
Right.
what we're seeing a lot, and there's nothing wrong with this, and I enjoy it a lot personally, is a lot of the drug-driven crime fiction is on a much smaller scale right now. Like it's in neighborhoods or amongst groups of people, and it's local to where the author is or somewhere that they have lived or whatever. But you took on something that is not only in a different country, but is addressing like a much bigger topic as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I wanted to add to, like, you know, was it intimidating to do it, and why did you kind of feel driven, like drawn to that story?
Sure. I think Berea's story was the catalyst for the whole thing. I never really worried, and maybe I should have more in hindsight, of, you know, taking on another culture. Like I said, I was more worried about treating her story respectfully, mm-hmm. even though it's not exactly the same. I'm pulling enough elements that I felt like I needed to be cognizant of that. But I guess I've read a lot and felt pretty comfortable that I was handling the Mexican culture well.
Right.
I guess for small versus large, I think large just kind of the wide scale. I guess for small scale, Mexico itself, I think part of one of the major themes of the book is that it's just kind of this all-encompassing force of you know, kind of corruption and violence that you can't really wrap your arms around. And I think sometimes I see Mexican cartels in particular kind of treated as this kind of cardboardy caricature when you see it, and probably more in film than in fiction and in books. And I kind of wanted to stay away from that. And so I think I hint at a lot of things, or hint at a lot of the presence of other forces in the book that you don't necessarily see close up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helps kind of maybe kind of cloud or shadow a lot of the things that you get an idea of, or you get a feeling or a vibe for what's going on, but you don't actually see exactly
right
who they are dealing with.
I feel like this question kind of leads off of that. The Marcos character, like, it seems like the reason that he goes into retirement, the reason he goes into hiding, is because he wasn't corrupted like you hear all these stories about, you know, the state of affairs in Mexican government and police work and stuff like that, and that he really wanted to do the right thing, and like he believed in doing the right thing. And the, you know, that gets whatever in the novel, but my question is do you think that, and this is, you know, pure speculation probably, but do you think that that is something that can or does exist in Mexico right now with the way things are? Like, I know that there are people who are actively fighting against the cartels, and the Mexican government has taken an official stance on it, but it almost seems like, you know, like you hear about in places like Afghanistan, like, it's not even always the Taliban or Al-Qaeda that's the issue. It's, like, the local drug lords, because they control all the money. So I wonder, right, like, do you think that someone like Marcos would even have a chance in contemporary Mexico right now?
That's tough. I mean, I to kind of go with the kind of Afghanistan example, maybe that I can think of, because I have a good friend who was in his former special forces over in Afghanistan. He did a lot of training, and he trained a lot of police, and he'd get, you know, for every 20 guys, he'd get 19 that didn't care, and you get one guy who was ready to go kick in doors and kill everyone because, you know, they knew who the bad guys were, but just no one wanted to go do anything about it.
Right.
And, you know, at the end of a year, my friend would be out, and, you know, they'd be left to do their work. And, you know, he didn't have a good feeling for that one guy who was motivated to do what was right. So, unfortunately, I don't think these guys do well because, you know, they just don't, the numbers aren't there, you know, and if,
right.
You know, if they, one wrong move, which is kind of what Marcos does in this, is, you know, make the wrong decision that leads him kind of through the rest of the novel. I think, you know, even a small gesture like that can give these guys away as not being trustworthy or, you know, especially when you're looking at a hierarchy in a lot of these organizations. They're, you know, one wrong move by a guy on the bottom of the ladder that could affect a guy higher up, you know, that
right.
They're just a person to be written off. So unfortunately, my gut tells me, yeah, that these kind of characters wouldn't fare so well in reality.
Yeah. Because it does seem like, you know, like I said, I'm aware that there is movement in Mexico. Like they're trying, but it's so corrupted, and there is, you know, unfortunately, when a place is super impoverished, it's easy to corrupt because people
right.
need to eat, you know. So, mm-hmm. like, the
well,
difference
even
between right and wrong
even look
becomes
at Whitey,
a lot blurrier.
Right, and even if you look at, you know, Whitey Bulger in Boston, there are still people in South Boston that love him because he was kind of their Robin Hood who gave him a turkey
right.
on Thanksgiving, you know, because they were poor and he had all the money and he was capable of doing that. So I think you'll find some of those characters with charisma who can, you know, have the money and, you know, quote unquote, take care of people when, you know, take care of their people or their town. And either the town turns a blind eye or they, you know, don't think about it and kind of go on with their life, you know, as best they can.
I mean, because that's kind of the roots of the mafia as well, is that they were genuinely protecting these neighborhoods and, you know, controlling the criminal element. But then as they became more powerful, they became as dangerous as what they were supposedly protecting the people from.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah,
if you look at, I think, what El Chapo was just arrested, what, like a month ago?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the kind of general reaction from people was kind of a shoulder shrug, like, you know, they got the head, but, you know, violence is only going to increase while people try to move in on him. So,
exactly.
You know, it's one of those things that's just like it just continues on and on.
So I don't have a good segue for this, but
no, it's like, how about that depressing conversation?
Everybody, take a drink. And okay. One thing I read that I thought was really interesting, and it's funny because I didn't think about this ever before. I read that you said you used Google Street View a lot while doing the locations. I think it's cool because I've definitely looked at Google Maps when I'm trying to write about somewhere I've lived, but I need to refresh my memory. I want to write about it or whatever. I never thought to use Street View, even though I use it all the time for other things. So I was wondering, were there other ways that you used to kind of get into the feel of this place that I guess might be different? Because, like, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, you have to go there. You can't write about a place that you don't know very well. But I don't know that that's necessarily true in the modern world.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I can tell you I have not been to any of the places that are referenced in the book. And I think there's nothing that really stands out to me outside of Street View. For whatever reason, especially in Tikamon, like the Eva's apartment above the dentist office, I think I just clicked a random street and started moving around, and I just saw that, and it the dentist office had a few bullet holes in the wall and the gate that was down in front of it and this kind of aquamarine tile floor, and then but everything above, and then giant Dentista and giant white letters, and then above it was this kind of really beige, boring looking apartment, and it kind of really just stuck out in my head as really interesting, and it was kind of examples like that that really stuck with me. And then, you know, Google Street View, while it blurs faces of people, you get tons of cars and people going about their daily lives, you know, everywhere. And I thought, found that was really interesting to see kind of some of the moments that you could pick up by just observing people on the street.
Yeah. So this book has sort of a like a film noir feel to it, and I know that you have said that you were inspired like by the idea of film noir in your writing, and I guess I wonder, like, what are the challenges of bringing a feeling of film noir, which, you know, you say that and people get a very distinct picture in their head of what you mean. Bringing that and marrying it with like contemporary Mexico.
Ooh, that's a tough one. I think not writing like film noir, not writing what you think people think of when they see film noir or think of film noir. I know my first couple of stories in my first novel had a lot of the feel down to the words of how people might speak, or it was just very, very old school, kind of James M. Cain, that era, noir speak maybe. An agent and an editor called me out on it, that I wasn't using my voice, that they saw a lot of old noir in it. And so that was kind of that. After that was kind of my challenge to how can I incorporate some of those themes without sounding like film noir.
Right.
So I don't know if I have a really good answer other than it's just kind of evolved, or I've tried to evolve over time and keep those ideas in my head, that, you know, there's a lot of tropes, I guess, that I try to avoid, but maybe work in bits of them. Like, I know Marcos has a lot of them, you know, he drinks a lot, you know, he's kind of at the end of his career, which are two big things you see in noir. But I think it's the challenge is really to create a believable people and that you want to stick with, knowing that it's not going to end up good for them. And I think that's the real challenge, especially in, you know, short stories are one thing, but longer works when, you know, you're investing, you know, hours of your time where it, you know, it's all going downhill. The whole, you know, should be going downhill most of the way, if you're really going for it, true noir. And it's that trying to find a way to keep people with you and keep them interested, sticking with your character. So I think that's kind of what really appeals to me with noir, is while it needs a really good story, you have to have great characters, or I hope I have, because you know, people aren't buying in into them. You know, the story really isn't what's going to get people there, because they know where it's going to go eventually. So they really need to buy in and enjoy your characters, whether
right.
they're likable or not likable. You know.
I wanted to sneak in a listener question real quick. We had one from Travis Richardson, and he asked about your editing for Shotgun Honey and
mm-hmm.
wanted to know if that had improved your skills as a writer, and what are some of the pros and cons of running a tri-weekly literary magazine?
It's a lot of reading and trying to make sure Ron Earl Phillips manages it. And so he kind of nudges us every once in a while to make sure. I mean, we never accept stories to make sure that we have stories. You know, because sometimes, occasionally, we get very close to, you know, we try to have a good long lead, or I guess we don't try to, but it's great to have a lead time, you know, of a month or more, just to make sure that we're not catching up, you know, and getting really close to our date of when we're publishing stories. And, you know, occasionally he nudges us because we read a lot, and we try to be, I think, pretty strict, because Shotgun Honey has really developed a great reputation over the years, and it's been great working with Jen Conley and Eric Arneson, reading all these stories. But I think it's done a lot for my writing, both reading great stories and stories that aren't so great, because you see, like I mentioned, violence. You see a lot of trends where immediately you're turned off because there isn't any character development. And, you know, it's difficult to develop a lot in 700 words, but I think some of the best stories we get do give you a great sense of place and character within those 700 words. So I've taken a lot away from some of those great stories. You know, like a lot of guys you've had on your show or in your podcast have had stories with Shotgun Honey.
Yep.
Joe Clifford just sent us a really great story, and I don't know if you've had Rob Hart on, but he's
going to be on.
Oh,
yes,
nice.
He is. 2 weeks, right?
I don't know for sure, but soon.
Nice, yeah.
I hope it's on next week. Sorry.
It's really funny. I read his bagel story in Thuglit, which is excellent, if anyone is looking to jump into Thuglit or hasn't read any of his, I think it's in the latest issue 10 or maybe 9. But it's a food noir story kind of, I was joking with him. And then recently, right after that, he sent us a story that dealt with food in New York City. And so I was joking with him that we need a Rob Hart food noir collection. And I think he's writing another one right now about tacos that he posted the other day.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but his stuff's really great.
It is 2 weeks, by the way. I just double checked the calendar. So
I have a schedule for my reading, you know. If I got scared.
Good. We're good.
So I always ask this because this is something I cannot do. I know I cannot do it because I tried and then I quit and I found someone else to do it. How hard is it when you get a story that's just bad? And, like, you know, because you have it, I feel like a lot of people who are reading have this idea in their head, like, I'm going to be one of those editors that always gives a personal response, that always gives feedback. And then every once in a while, you'll get one where you're like, I literally do not have anything nice to say about this. Or this person is so far off base or so new that it would take pages. You know, like, how do you, like, do you feel bad? Or are you at a point now where it's just like water off a duck's back?
I think we put that on Eric a lot because he sends out, he's, I got to give a ton of props to him because he's been sending out, I think for over a year now, or close to a year. I think we've all, Jen, Eric, and I have all been on for about a year now, working with Ron. And I think for the entire time, Eric's been the one to send out our acceptances and rejections. And with all the rejections, he does send out our notes. So whenever we read a story, we use a spreadsheet, we put yes or no or rewrite, et cetera, and we all comment on, unless it's a yes, we all comment on, you know, why we made that decision. And so then Eric pulls our comments together and makes it look a little nicer and kicks it out to the author. So usually I try to put them in some kind of form that, you know, is critical, but you know, productive or positive in a way, or something they can take away from their story and do something better. But, you know, occasionally I think I do kind of throw it in his corner, or maybe I'm just being lazy or something. But yeah, if it's a really brutal story and I have, I know there was one the other day that was just so out of control and I didn't even know what to say. I was just kind of...
It's like a line by line that reads, no. No.
Yeah, it was just
fuck,
yeah, I think
no.
Like after the letter no, you know, and in the box. And there's been a few of those that are just kind of just crazy. Or we'll get some that are just, and I think other publishers probably deal with this more. I know horror deals with this a lot, where people just don't even look at what the publication is. They just send something.
It's like
and
a
so,
like,
yeah, we had a we had I think three women that all looked like they might have been friends, because it was I think two had the same college in their bio, and they all got all sent to us within like 2 hours, and they were all poetry. There were two were poetry and one was something else but similar, but it was nothing close to what we published. So, you know, it was almost one of those shotgun blasts where they were hitting, you know, who knows, maybe they hit 10 publications in one day, or
seven,
every story they had in one day. So we get some of those, and that's more of a, you know, this just isn't right for shotgun honey kind of responses.
I always wonder how people find, like, when you, like, I know when I'm looking for places to submit, well, now it's different because now I kind of know where I want to be. But before, when I was, like, kind of relying on Duotrope and whatever, like, don't you read, like, the little blurb that says what the magazine's about? Like, don't you, like, how did you find out how to submit without ever stumbling across what kind of a market it was?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for like... I think for Shotgun Honey, the Both Barrels Anthology Volume 3, which we're accepting submissions for right now, we got, so if any listeners want to send in stories, I think May 11th is the deadline.
But no poetry, guys.
No poetry, yeah. We're looking for like 1,500 to like 5,000 words. So it's supposed to, you know, it's like the same Shotgun Honey, but just expanded, so you can give us something bigger than 700. But some guy sent us his full-length novel without any hint of it in the email. I think his submission didn't mention anything about a full-length novel. It was like, hope you enjoy this. And I was like, okay. You know, not reading.
Hope you enjoy this. I won't.
snorted coffee right then.
And occasionally some people will send us like 3,000-word stories to Shotgun Honey and say, you know, I could cut this down, but I thought it was awesome, or I could cut it down, but I didn't want to, kind of in the email. And we do publish occasionally some that are slightly longer than 700, especially if there's someone who's published with us before. But
you're
know,
talking
it's just
about
kind
like,
of odd.
Like still in the flash fiction range, like.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we, you know, we have on there like, you know, try to hit at 700 or less, and they send us crazy numbers, and you know, there are a lot of great places for crime fiction that are more than 700. This is kind of, you know, us in Flash Fiction Offensive, you know, with Tom and Joe. That's kind of the two out there that kind of run Flash Fiction. So there, you know, there's a lot of other places to send stuff.
Did you have something, Jessica?
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. So we heard that you were doing a comic book or a graphic novel.
Yes.
Tell us about that. That's exciting.
Yeah, thanks. I'm excited. I started it quite a while ago, like 2 years ago maybe, a year and a half. But I love comics. I think I read more crime comics growing up than actual crime fiction. I was a big fan of The Punisher. It was my favorite superhero, and Batman, you know, has a lot of crime and mystery themes throughout. And then the newer stuff like Ed Brubaker is Criminal and Scalp. There's a ton of great crime comics out there. And I kind of thought of writing one, but I had no idea where to start. And then I kind of thought, well, why not get a book and read about writing graphic novel and comic books? And so I did that and took a class, I guess, back in like 2011. And in the class, they recommend, so the hard thing, it's really hard for a writer to break into comics because the cost of art is so high.
Right.
You know, professionals, it could be $100 to $200 per page. And if you're looking at a 24 or 26-page comic, you know, you're looking at $2,500.
I had no idea it was that expensive.
Yeah, and that's just for black and white. Like, most...
Oh, wow.
You know, that's on the low end. you know, and some are cheaper, but if you're looking for someone, I think, who can, who will be a professional and understand not just illustrating, but panel to panel and actually moving the story forward, I think is also, this is coming from a writer, but I think it's, I've seen a lot of artists who are amazing illustrators at single images, but when you look at some of their work in comics, or they just don't do comics because it takes them longer, it's just different. So the class I took at Grub Street in Boston, which is a little writing school, they recommended writing mini comics, like 4-page to 8-page. That way, you know, you can develop something. It still costs a lot potentially, but you can play with scripts. And if you think you have something that could be potentially viable at you know, 4 to 8 pages, that's at least a tease to pitch to an editor, or you know, at least show what you can do as a writer potentially.
Right.
So I wrote an 8-page script, and then that kind of started into something that fell apart. And then in Boston Comic Con last year, I met Ricardo Lopez Ortiz, who's the artist who's working with me on this. Just kind of ran into him by accident. Loved his artwork. He did a Judge Dredd commission for me. And then I think a couple months afterwards, I was like, I had this 8-page script with ideas of making a lot more. And hit him up kind of out of the blue, like, hey, I got the script. Like, would you be interested in doing it? I could pay you, you know, to do 8 pages. And then he loved the script, and we kind of struck it off really well. And then I said, you know, I got all these other ideas. Would you be interested? So I wrote up, or I wrote the first full issue, kicked it to him, and then we kind of went back and forth, and then kind of went from there. So we've planned a 5-issue arc at least. And I guess I could say it's a crime noir-ish. About a white-collar criminal American who flees after being arrested for embezzling money to Brazil, to Rio, current time. So around after the World Cup, before the Olympics. So I don't know if you're aware of anything going down in Rio right now, but the military is raiding all the favelas and basically pacifying them. So because the favelas are kind of run by either drug warlords or, yes, police, but they're more militias that are no longer law enforcement. They just run the favela without the drugs, or maybe with the drugs, but they're kind of this faux law enforcement. So the military's gone in and taken out both, and then they bring in the UPP, which is the state-run police. So it's almost kind of having a federal-level police come in and hold a favela after the military has come in to take everyone out.
So it's almost like an occupation, kind of?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, totally.
I mean, it's
totally
their own country, but...
Yeah.
And there is a vast difference between, like, the way the favelas and the rest of Brazil anyway, but... Yeah, and that sounds really interesting to me.
Thanks, yeah. So it's gone... He's done, you know, he did the pencils for the first 8, and he's working on the inks. And so we started that Tumblr that you might have seen, mm-hmm. to kind of start teasing something different every week until we can kind of get enough, either get some buzz or try to pitch the comic to a publisher.
Cool. One thing that I forgot to ask is I read something, and I didn't know if it was true or not, or if it was like a misunderstanding, but I read that Federalis was the first in a series. Did they, like, because I know it was like one of the first One Eye Press releases. Is that what is meant by first in a series? It's not, you're not going to do like a sequel?
I plan to. Spiritual sequel. It's totally standalone. I mean, as people will get kind of reading it. Recently, it's kind of inspired by the militias that have sprung up in Western Mexico. And I think you might have alluded to this earlier tonight. There's like a 20,000 strong militia that's risen up kind of in the same area that Federalis takes place. And they ran out the Knights Templar cartel and took over a lot of cities, you know, sandbag checkpoints and everything. And then the Mexican government didn't like that, so they sent out the military. And then there's been back and forth. And I haven't checked it in the past couple of weeks because it's not making headline news anymore. It did as when it first broke out, but they were butting heads, and there were some exchanges of gunfire between the military and the militia, but they were kind of coexisting. But then the militia started to have some rifts within it because, you know, who runs a 20,000 strong militia, you know?
Right.
But I just found this just to be an incredible story. So that gave me a lot of ideas to kind of explore, because I'd love to do another, and I plan to do one to two more of books kind of in the same theme, but I only want to do them if I could explore similar themes but a different story that doesn't feel like a retread. You know, like, I don't want people to pick it up and say, oh, this is good, but it's the same. So I've outlined a second book that I feel like has very different characters and touches on some very different things that I think would be a lot of fun to write. So I hope to do that this summer, and so that it could come out maybe the same time, you know, February, March next year.
Oh, cool.
So
exciting.
Fingers crossed. I just need to I feel pretty good about the outline, so I just need to sit down and do it.
That does tend to be the most important part of the,
right,
the novel writing,
right,
process, is the novel writing. So I guess the question that's on my mind, and maybe is on a lot of our listeners' mind, is, could you give us like a little bit of some insight into how exactly One Eyed Press burst onto the scene to be publishing books? Because I know, like, this is relatively recent. So I'm interested in these things. Maybe, like, what was the decision-making? Because I know you're involved at Shotgun Honey, and I know, so mm-hmm. Do you, like, have any insight into, like, what is the drive, I guess? You know, there's a lot of these smaller presses popping up. What is the drive of, like, going to that bigger, better?
Sure. So Ron has, you know, done everything. It's his baby. And he was thinking about doing this back mid last year, I think. I had already finished Federalized, at least, you know, multiple drafts, but not the final version. And I think he emailed a lot of people involved with Shotgun Honey, just saying, here, because Kent Gowron started it a few years ago. And so he kicked out an email saying, you know, this is what I'm thinking of doing with it. Everyone thinks this is cool, et cetera, et cetera. And everyone thought it was great that he tried to do some different things and kind of have an umbrella press over Shotgun Honey. So there's Blight Digest, which will be starting in the fall, which will be a horror zine. And then he has the Big Audios, which is the Western. So it's kind of slowly growing every year.
Right.
And Novellas, I think Snubnose is doing some, but there wasn't. And Crime Factory has done a couple that were very good. But there weren't a lot of places that were doing small work.
Right.
He was going to start that up, and I think Ron's a total professional. Like, his background is doing this kind of design work, and he's worked on comics, and he's done a lot of this stuff. And that was one of my, I don't know if pet peeves, but kind of, I guess, requirements for a first thing for me to publish kind of on my own, is I really wanted to look good, and I feel really comfortable with the way he formats work and designs everything. And
yeah,
I kept kind of poking him, like, would you be interested in this? And I think finally he read it, you know, last fall and accepted it. So I was really happy about that, and the fact that I've become good friends with him since we all met at BoucherCon in Albany, and I've become good friends with him since. But I didn't get a treatment like I was a friend. I mean, he definitely gave me the straight answer of yes and gave me the reasons why. And, you know, we worked out some other things. So I felt good that it wasn't him just kind of publishing it to publish it.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
No, it makes total sense, because that's the last thing you want to feel like, is that maybe it isn't that good. Like, you know.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And I know he wants to grow it even more. I think he's trying to do 6 releases this year, maybe, of books, and like even more next year. Maybe reach double digits next year. So I think if anyone, you know, I try to help him get the word out for more submissions for novellas. But if anyone else out there is listening and is interested in writing a novella or has a novella, definitely hit up when I press with a query.
Cool. So we're running a little bit short on time now, and I think this has been like, you know, I feel like this has been one of our episodes where we hit on like a lot of deep stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, like we have episodes that are just like goofy from start to finish, and then we have episodes like this that are like, so we're going to talk about some world issues. We're going to.
You have to prepare me with Tom and Joe next time.
Right. No, they're never coming on as a pair again. That was insanity. That was pure
insanity. It'll just derail your show from the first minute.
It'll just, yeah, like, Books and Booze will implode if we do that again. No, they're great guys.
But really,
they're a little bit overwhelming together on a show. Like, because nobody can see each other, right?
Right, right.
So you always have a moment where someone either talks over each other or they're almost due or, you know, whatever. So when there's 4 people, they have to be a calmer 4 people than Joe and Tom. So yeah, no, I really want to thank you for coming on and doing the show. And, really looking forward to seeing this comic book.
Thanks.
It's exciting to me.
Thanks very much for having me.
And just once again, for our listeners at home, we're being brought to you by High Octane Damnation, which is, we've talked about it quite a bit on the show. It's been compared to Christine. It's, sounds like pure grindhouse, crazy, like, I don't know. I haven't read it. It's not out yet, but maybe it's like the first half of Death Proof. Sounds really pulpy and grindhousey to me. Sounds like a good time. There's cars, there's boobs, there's blood, right? Who doesn't want that? And once again, and I have an announcement to make. Our lovely music supervisor instructed me on how to pronounce her name. So I fucked it up last week and just, like, admitted that I had never said it out loud before. It's Mignona. Danielle Mignona. it's gotten us some great music again this week. And we're listening to Werewolf by Tyler Lyle.
Some days I am Caesar, some days I am Christ, some days Saint Teresa, oh by golly, some days I play nice, and some days I am a mother. Some days you are a motherfucking werewolf. if I see you tonight.